Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. I'm L.A. Steele. And tonight we're going to talk about a tradition of giants and by a book by Ross Hamilton. And I'm doing this tonight as an introduction program to our Friday night show, which is coming up next tomorrow. When I have Ross Hamilton on the show with George Dixon, who is our regular Friday night guest, and George knows of Ross and has invited him on the program, and I really look forward to talking to him. And I have a book here called by Ross, put out by. Showing a Susquehanna male, upper right, in the upper right of this picture, says they measure the calf of the largest man's leg and found it 3/4 of a yard about, and all the rest of his limbs were in proportion, so that he seemed the stateliest and most goodly personage they had ever beheld. His arrows were 5/4 yards long, headed with the splinters of a white crystal like stone. That was published in London in 1624. It's called A Map Courtesy Library of Congress, originally entitled Virginia Discovered and Described by Captain John Smith, 1606, graven by William Hole. And there's a picture of, in the left-hand corner of this map, that shows this giant, of a person kind of leaning in. Or leaning on his sword, almost as though he's the king of the world. You know what I mean? That look, like, you know, great man. Let's start. Preface and introduction. They're lengthy, but there's I probably should go through that. However, The Heritage of Surprising Bearing, or Surpassing Bearing, by Leclerc Brant's Jefferson Stance. That was an argument on the superiority of the French over the new country, the United States, during Jefferson's presidency. And this rant goes on. As an attack against the sophistication and intelligence of the Americans, and Jefferson's stance on that, bringing up the evidences of this giant race of men found in North America, and Jefferson, being a Mason, was well aware of the value of archaeological finds and the true mapping of. He was a scientist, above all things. Jefferson was a brilliant scientist and mathematician. He's just an amazing man. I think what I'm going to do is probably follow the author's idea here and just the start of the beginning. He has an interesting page here at the front of the page, in front of the book, and it says, in reply to an inquiry made by Secretary George Martin of Kansas State Historical Society, Attorney General Jackson handed down an opinion in the effect that it is just as much of a crime to open Indian graves as in the interest of archaeological research as it is to open the graves of the white people. He says, the law nowhere permits the opening of graves for architectural or scientific research. I know of no reason, he says, in conclusion, why Indian graves should be despoiled by any more than another. The rights of the red man should be respected as much as those of whites or blacks. He says, all the natural instincts and feelings of humanity cry out against the violation of sepulture. Except in the interest of justice or prompted by motives of love and duty, the sanctity of each deceased person 6 feet of earth should not be disturbed. And that was Sacredness of Indian Graves, Ohio, History, Volume 16, page 420, date unknown. So anyway, I just wanted to go on. I'll start to show some fascinating pictures in here regarding certain things. There's a picture called the Serpent Mound, circa late 19th to early 20th century. It says, believed by many indigenous people to have been the formal lodge of Glitch Manito, primal spirit, called in the Western tribal traditions Wankan Tonka, the great mystery. Ohio's great serpent, like Britain's Stonehenge, attracted uncounted generations of native people to its holy shrine. The remains of men and women of exceedingly tall and robust form have been discovered in virtually all countries surrounding and including this ancient site. And because traditionally many of them were considered special incarnations of spiritual potencies, it is conceivable that the tall ones operated the holy shrine in remote prehistory. Preface and introduction. During the excavation, many human bones were unearthed that crumbled to dust upon exposure to the air. One of the skulls found was said to be big enough to fit over a man's head. It's as singular as this may seem, similar reports of the time emanated from over 20 other Ohio counties. It is one of the great enigmas of Western and world anthropology. Who were they, from where did they come, and why did they disappear? The facts declare that where we live today, people of an implausible stature once resided in numbers enough to view their social order as different from any known to ethnologists. In America, a great human mystery lingers closely, or rather ghostly, over the land, and yet languishes nearly away. Over the face of the country, throughout Ohio and adjoining states, the extinct race of giant men have written a mystic chord of their existence in hieroglyphics, perhaps uninterruptible. And this dead race of giants, who were they? We know very little about the prehistory of the Americas, especially perhaps North America. And the environmental changes, coupled with social and political upheavals, alter everything quickly and thoroughly. The once extensive legacy of native oral history has become radically diminished, even extinguished, along with various languages and dialects. Apart from those rare oral transmissions saved, virtually all we have today are literary fragments from eclectic sources connected through time with early European explorers and the later settlers who crossed over the Allegheny Range. It was once understood by native people that before the tall ones disappeared completely, they generally comprised a root subrace embodying a privileged class, including social and military heads. Their forebears, from an earlier archaic timeline, before 1000 BCE, were held to have been an ancient and noble family, and their descendants managing to maintain a powerful and dignified presence throughout the three segments of the woodland period, which ended in European colonization. With only the rare exception, modern anthropology has difficulty admitting these people ever existed. Their loss by and large stems from archaeological practices beginning in the 18th and 19th centuries. When this research began here in Ohio, our direction naturally went right to lettered academics and authorities. An expert on the Ohio Hopewell culture said that he vaguely recalled mention of very large skeletal remains when he was in college. But that was it, because it seemed more like anecdotal rumor than fact. And the subject of that very tall stature among ancient Ohio folk did not seem a worthy pursuit. Unknown to him and us at the time, the tall ones became simultaneously discovered and lost through the rape and abandon of ancient cemeteries, tombs, and mounds. Hang on a second here. Throughout the Americas, from the very early 1800s, such cavalier and cowboy exertions into the private domains of prehistoric unwittingly forged the foundations for modern American anthropology and archaeology. The brief post-Columbian pre-colonial period witnessed the traditions of giants from California to Massachusetts, and our oldest native accounts relate that these folks were found throughout the land for the most remote periods available to memory. Wonderful stories of hunting expeditions and military excursions relate of meetings with very large and powerful people as the long-established gentry of the district visited. The Iroquois, the Osage and Tuscaroras, the Hurons and Omahas, and many other North American Indians all speak of giant men who once lived and roamed in the territories for their God, for their forefathers. All over what is now the U.S., are traditions of these ancient giants. But stories and oral traditions have done little to move either Darwinian precept or political expedience away from the discrediting of American Indian history. The exclusion of spoken testimony in the reasoning that it did not meet critical academic standards has aggravated the problem. Besides this, the diversity of native dialects has not encouraged funding for studies in this area. There are uncounted stories that contain references to giants, such as a number collected through the scholarly efforts of Roger L. That were, prior to this bringing them forth, classified away from the paths of customary research. Complicating the already hazy picture, there is great suspicion of a mysterious loss of Adena, Hopewell, and simply anomalous artifacts once perceived in possession of the Smithsonian, making it nearly impossible for their current staff to confirm or deny remains of tall folk and such rarities appropriated in the 19th century. In the ongoing polishing of this public image, the National Museum has garnered the prehistory of the United States and, with polite apologetics, has conjured a masterful illusion that no wrong has been effected. In the meanwhile, efforts admitted from prominent figures in American archaeology unaffiliated with the National Museum have suggested the possible existence of a hierarchical order of exceptionally tall and vigorous men and women throughout the Eastern American woodland cultures. Names like Moorhead, Webb, Snow, and Dragoo have been referenced with interesting insights. The very root of the problem is realizing that the bones have disappeared because of our forebears' insatiable and morbid curiosity. Over time, motivated by greed, even today we cannot leave the old graves and tombs alone. Throughout the 19th century, the remains of giants were considered wonderful curios and disappeared rapidly, never to be seen again. Like the use of the traditional medicine bag, many of the stories were of spiritual or religious nature and were kept secret from the whites, as if to follow the biblical adage adjoining one not to cast pearls before swine. They supposed their ancestors to have been much more perfect, both in intellectual and bodily formation, than the present race. They were of very large stature. Both men and women attributed in part to their abstinence from sexual intercourse during the early years of life. In those days, the men at 100 years were equal to those of the present race at 70. So a person 100 would be equal to a person 70 today. A gradual degeneration has at last brought them to their present state and is now working imperceptibly among all of the Indian tribes. In the same light, there was once a world tradition of very tall and strong people, all gone now. An example in the work of Adrienne Mayer, who uncovered this among many other fascinating bits in her first Fossil Hunters, which is the name of the book. And he quotes Augustine, A.D. 354 to 430, was when he lived. The famous bishop from North Africa writes in the City of God that some people refuse to believe that in previous ages men's bodies were of much larger size than they are now. In those days, the earth used to produce larger bodies. As for the size of the bodies, skeptics are generally persuaded by the evidence in graves uncovered by the ravages of time, the violence of streams, or the various other occurrences. For incredibly large bones of the dead have been found in them and dislodged from them. Felagon of Trowles, who lived in AD, or 130 AD, wrote in a book of marvels, in his book of marvels, that one should not believe in these bones, either considering that in the beginning, when nature was in her prime, she produced substantial creatures. But just as time is running down, so also the size of creatures have been shrinking. Right? That was Augustine's quote. I got a little confused on that. Saint Augustine. Okay. And then the author goes on to say, we self-immolate our ancestors' remains. Through the morbid practice of tomb burrowing, especially once a new order established itself in a given country. Philostratus, who lived in 170 to 245 CE, a Greek writer of several works, including the life of Apollonius of Tyana, once banned by the church, quotes the great sage as saying, as having said, I agree that giants once existed and that in that gigantic bodies are revealed all over the earth, with mounds are broken open, although it is mad to believe they fought the gods. Nature does her part as well. Pliny the Elder wrote a very famous 37-volume natural history completed in 77 A.D., in which he used many ancient sources that, not surprisingly, are now lost. He wrote, it is a matter of observation that the stature of the entire human race is becoming smaller. He observed that giant skeletons have been dug up, and also mentioned that the Greek poet Homer, nearly 1,000 years ago, never ceased to lament that mortals were of smaller stature than in the old days. The Hindu Puranas, also state that the stature of the average person as well as the human lifespan, became diminished with the segments of time as diminished by the four metallic ages governing the ascending and descending spiritual content of life. The Native American Indian traditional stories have averred the identical thing. Both the animals and men have grown smaller with the passage of time since the late Pleistocene age, I guess. Due to a loss of access to the spiritual dimension once directly perceived and familiar to all. Far more has been lost than we can imagine. War, natural disaster, and cataclysmic events have shaken the very foundation of the world and its memories. But grave robbing is the darkest enemy of all, because there is virtually no physical evidence of a genetically related family of giants in ancient North America. It is not hard to understand the same fate of loss having afflicted the entire world before, during, and after the time of our oldest records. Native American traditions clearly narrate of all tall and impressively constructed men and women whose lives and deeds have the stuff of legends to the old tribal families. They are a royal class who were said to be descended from an ancient family, but they of the European descent never ceased to ridicule the beliefs of native folks, creating racial tensions and social taboos, even as the social fabric of the people became disseminated by disease, relocation, and serious efforts at genocide. Coupled with the demolition of the mounds and tombs, the fate of the native man and his remarkable way of life has been sealed. And that's sad, but we're seeing this constant taking away of sacred grounds and burial grounds and things like that, and destroying the all evidence of cultures that existed prior. And it's devastating what has been so callously allowed to happen everywhere around the world. And how many races of people and how many types of people have existed and become extinct, and their bones and their links. I mean, it's so amazing to me how the missing link has never seemed to be found. You know, it's always called missing link. But the missing link here is these these truths that happen to come up when you understand it, when you understand genetics. Actually, it's phenomenal. Actually, any understanding how one gene can be traveled down through, or one chromosome, or all of these things that can happen by just traveling down through generation upon generation upon generation, from mother to son to daughter, and that kind of thing. So it's like and all the millions of possibilities. It's like I once remember ophthalmologist I went to once told me, as I used to wear glasses, and not until I cured my vision through a book that I read, and it was called Training Your Eyes, I believe, or something. Training Your Eye. I got the book. I read the book back in the early 70s, why I'm mentioning that book, for instance, is that it taught you how to correct your vision without medication. And taught you how to train your eyes so that you could actually train your eyes or your, like any muscle, to respond like we do. So if you're having bad vision, if you're wearing glasses, your glasses would weaken your eyes rather than strengthen them. They would make them lazier. So you had a series of exercises to build up the eye muscle and to build up the eye and the cornea, the different parts of the eye. And so for that, I became I became fascinated with it, and it really brought me to a 2020, a little better actually than 2020. And prior to that, I thought I was so nearsighted that I thought I'd always be wearing glasses. But it wasn't. It didn't take long. I would say within 3 weeks, I had my vision had been fully restored, where I could see, you know, I could see distances and everything that were blurry at one time. I could see them very well and sharp, and make out details that I couldn't make out before. So I was very fortunate. And actually, after that stigmatism or whatever they call it, myopia, where you're nearsighted, that was corrected. And I had worn glasses since I was in third grade, I believe. Yeah. And that's when I realized I couldn't read the board. And being the big kid in class, you always wind up in the back of the class. So it made it impossible for me to read or see what was going on the board there. When people, and that was when, those were in the days when the teachers actually wrote on the boards, all at the joint class, and you had to take notes even in third grade. So, it became known, you know, I couldn't see the board. I got a pair of black horn rim glasses, and I wore those night, those talk about geeko, man. I used to keep them in my pocket all the time because they looked so geeky. But that's what they had back then, horn rim glasses. They didn't have anything other. They didn't have any other kind of glasses for kids. And so you imagine a three-year-old kid wearing black horn rim glasses. He learned to get serious real quick in the classroom. But taking that back, genetics, the ophthalmologist told me, that genetics, due to genetics, he says, nobody knows who's going to get what disease or you know, he says, it's amazing that so many people come out normal, with normal vision, hearing, that there actually is a normal, he said, because it's like spinning a wheel of fortune. He says, what you're going to get, what you're not going to get. He says, you can spin the wheel and go bankrupt and spin the wheel and get every perfect thing, you know, beauty and perfect vision, athletic body, and, you know, that kind of thing. Or you can get, you know, all kinds of problems. So it's a wheel of fortune. So, well, after when he said that, I always felt fortunate that I was able to spin that genetic wheel to, spun well for me. And I've always been thankful for that. But getting back to the giants, getting back to the concepts that this provokes, is that that it's very believable to me. And when George first brought this up to me a number of years ago, talking about giants and so on, I started to understand that. And of course, you know, everybody remembers the biblical giant who was Goliath. And he was a great warrior for the Galatians. I forgot that story, but all you really remember is who got the last laugh when David threw the rock at his head. So, the little guy killed all the big guys. So it's like that's probably what happened. You know, big guys thought they were invincible, but they were actually very vulnerable, just as vulnerable as small people were to certain, because they had human bodies. So even though they might have been 8 or 10 or 16 or 18 feet tall, they were still human bodies and had bled and so on. So it was, they were still vulnerable to disease and whatnot. So, in keeping with this rule of treating all as worthy in some large picture, it was enlightening to uncover by serendipity a segment of lost prehistory. And linking the movements of the tall ones with good anthropology, carbon dating, and rare native timelines contained in the stories, a crucial period highlighting the old hierarchical social structure was pieced together. While there are references to much earlier periods, These mainly document a length of time extending back about 3,500 years and forward up to the first European visitors. This, as is common knowledge, there have been proverbial giants, i.e. great men and women among Indian people from times long past, and a few of them are mentioned by name in this work. Yet, concerned as this research has been with the lost age of the physically very tall people, we have been hard-pressed to uncover their stories save that of the sweet peacemaker of Iroquoian tradition, whom we firmly believe may have been both exceptionally tall physically as well as a giant of spirituality. Yet, overall, while it seems sadly apparent that the great chieftains, the holy medicine personages, and some exponents of the arts of defense throughout prehistoric times truly inspired and led their nations to greater perceptions of life and spirit, their stories are like their physical remains, lost to us. It is one of our researchers' greatest regrets that, having been able to take its investigation as far as this, it has been unable to relate the stories and exploits of these mighty men and women. Perhaps with time someone will come forward with a view of them. It has been brought to my attention by, especially in spending time with some native people, that photographs of Native American skeletal remains, however ancient, are felt to be inappropriate for publication, in that the reasoning that such visible evidence tends to open the door of greater acceptance in the minds of some, yet in keeping with the wish that Indian sanctity by and large be kept inviolate, only one photo and one drawing of such remains have been included in this work. I sincerely and with humility apologize to anyone who finds this difficult decision uninspired. In any case, it is with heartfelt thanks to all who have helped in this labor of love that this work is presented, as is to all who might enjoy or benefit from it. In this post, NAGPRA, NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection and Reparation Act era, it is hoped that scholarship may begin the uphill task to remove the veil abetting the fixed notion of an inscrutable prehistory to the benefit of all. R.H., Cincinnati, Spring 2005. Beyond the realms of Gaul, beneath the sunset, lieth an island girt about an ocean, guarded by an ocean, erst the haunt of giants. That was written by Jeffrey of Monmouth. The next chapter I find rather fascinating because it's entitled A Heritage of Surprising Bearing and Leclerc's Rant, Jefferson's Stance. Okay. And starts up, there are the finest men we have ever seen. They are gigantic, with an exclamation point. And that's President Thomas Jefferson noting the Washington visit of the Osage delegation. When the famous European naturalist and philosopher George Louis Leclerc, from 1707 to 1788, began to publicize his new idea of the tendency of nature to belittle her productions of the American side of the Atlantic. Thomas Jefferson elected to defend his own beloved New World as he might, and Buffon, or Leclerc, whose name Comte de Buffon, who was known for his provocative messages to the Americans, and lacking in savoir-faire, attempting to paint a picture of the colonies and the New World's people as inferior to European traditions. On the subject of Jefferson versus Buffon, Joyce Appleby writes, among the many tribes that Lewis and Clark encountered, the Osages and the Mandans were the most impressive. Lewis had extended an invitation to the Osage Nation to send a delegation to Washington to meet the president. Jefferson rejoiced to discover the men the men's considerable height, no doubt thinking of his protracted challenge to Buffon's theory of New World degeneracy. Preceded by other invited tribes from July of 1804, the arrival of the Osage gentry in December of 1805 was described by Mrs. Margaret Banner Smith in these words: "Tall, erect, finely proportioned, and majestic in their appearance, dignified, graceful, and lofty in their demeanor, they seem to be nature's own nobility." Had these people not been seen by the early French, the Jeffersonian Society, and others, including the frontier painter George Catlin, we might today have no authentic record of their venerable lineage. The number were said to have been 7 feet tall, robust, and especially later in life, and heavy set. Some believe them to be related to the older Cherokee gentry originating of Tennessee, who also tend to be tall, strong, and heavy. But the story of their origins reaches yet deeper into prehistory, as their tribal legends relate of having originated in very ancient times out of the Ohio Valley. The next chapter is called Problems Facing Anthropology. I may read that. This chapter gets big man system. Six reasons of loss. There's some fascinating. I'm trying to get around some of this stuff, but it's very well documented and rather difficult to jump around without missing part of the major points of the book. So bear with me here as I go through this a little. Overlooking the Osage. Now modern authors agree with Osage warriors that Osage warriors were among the largest Indians in the West, some 7-footers among them. Yeah, I think of here you got over 7 foot, but you got to think of the Watusis, the Watusi tribe. With everyone over 7 feet tall, you know, a lot of people go, 7 feet tall and more. I believe, is it the Watusis? Yeah, I forget. They're a famous tribe, but I might be wrong. Yeah, it's the Watusi tribe. I had the privilege back in, I think it was 2004, I was able to film a speech given by Manute Bol, and I don't know if you're familiar with Manute Bol. He just passed away recently, and he was an NBA All-Star basketball player. He was I believe he was 7'2" or 7'4", and I met the man, talked with him, and actually filmed one of his speeches that he gave. And he was a very tireless activist for human rights and in Africa and human issues facing the African people. And he gave a lot of money and donated a lot of things, a lot of time. But he gave this remarkable speech and he just basically talked about his. It was a motivational speech, actually, to so many people that seem to that kids on their graduation from a very difficult what's the word I'm looking for? Severely institutionalized school that I taught as a teacher. Actually, I was an art teacher there for a summer as a student, as a replacement teacher for the summer. And this incredible school of just kids that were beyond the abilities of any academic institution to maintain, you know, to contain without, you know, putting them all into. And they were too young to be in prison. Kids with a whole bunch of different issues and problems. But I was their art teacher. Yeah. So, you know, it was quite something. And but what I'm saying is that we have a tendency to marginalize people and to diminish people and to place them and ignore them, you know, even though it may cost a fortune to the state or the community to keep a kid in some institution like this. It's also it's extremely generous of that community. And I've always felt that that was such a remarkable gift, you know, that any community, and I say it's community because it's the communities, local communities that pay, or states, you know, individual states that pay for these wards of the state, if you will. They're all wards of the state to be educated until the age of 18. And, you know, so there's plenty of money and big bucks go into, and of course the degree of difficulty the child was. But I guess what I'm saying is that if there were any, you know, it's a sign of a civilization. It's a sign of to me, it's a sign of a civilized, enlightened civilization that would pay substantial amounts of money to and set up total all these programs, you know, for children, troubled children, and places that will, you know, you, unfortunately you incarcerate to a degree. You have to incarcerate them even though it's a very minimal security, but to people that could easily be diminished, just extinguished from this society, and never. In fact, there are many, many studies and, you know, eugenicists who have, you know, wanted to sterilize these people, and, you know, people like that, people who commit violent crimes, or people who commit sexual crimes, or, you know, whatever they may be, or, you know, just do away with them, and so. Where, you know, it's capital punishment and so on, but when you, what I'm saying is that you never really know who it's going to be. It could be in any family. It could be, I taught kids who were wealthy and taught kids who were, you know, poor, and they both had pretty much the same problems. But the key that I'm getting at is Newt Bowl was a giant of and it was one of the but he talked about him running away from the Bible about 13. And he left. He was already very tall. He was already, you know, 6'8" or something, you know, incredibly tall as a kid. And he got away, and he got away from the village, hopped on a boat freight boat or something. He hid away as, I don't know, a 6'8" guy could hide away as a hideaway. But he did. And he got on this freighter or something, and he sailed across to New York, got off in New York, then he got caught and sent back. So then he tried again a year later, and he succeeded into the United States. He'd always dreamed to come here. So at 14 or 15 years old, Manute Bol was by himself in the center of New York City, knowing nobody, having no money, but being 7 feet tall, and walking around, and everybody just gawking at him. And so one guy who met him in New York City, who happened to be a coach for Bridgeport University of Bridgeport, and he asked the kid if he knew if he had, you know, what he was doing, where he was from, and so on and so forth. And next thing, he befriended him and brought him home with him and brought him to the university and got him enrolled as a player, and taught Manute Bol everything he knew about basketball. By the time he was 18 years old, he was offered an NBA contract. You know, so it was. He was a fascinating guy, and I was very fortunate to be able to capture that on video. And I did that. I filmed that privately for my own company, but I was working as a videographer for the school at that time for that particular project. And I was the art teacher as well, but I was able to film it and keep it and broadcast it. On my own show. But the Giants exist. And you look at, I mean, especially if you look at the basketball players, I mean, my God, the size of some of these guys, you know, how do you get so big? How do you get as big as Shaq? Or, you know, there must be some genetic material there, you know, to create, within our system, to create these giant men, you know, and, so anyway, that's where that was a long way around what I was trying to get at, but nevertheless. Then there's testimonies of different people who saw them at the time and wrote about them, and. On the Mississippi and its waters are many and numerous nations, the best known of which are the Osages, situated on the river at the same name on the right bank of the Missouri, at about 8 leagues from its confluence with it. They consist of 1,000 warriors who live in 2 settlements at no great distance from each other. They are of a gigantic stature and well-proportioned, are enemies of the whites and of all other Indian nations, and commit depredations from the Illinois to the Arkansas. The trade of this nation is said to be under an exclusive grant. They are a cruel and ferocious race, and are hated and feared by all. Charlevoix says, the Arkansas are reckoned to be the tallest and best shaped of all the savages of this continent, and they are called, by way of distinction, the fine men. Later in 1890, from the Department of the Interior Census Office, a report on Indian taxed and Indians not taxed in the United States, 11th census, says, Great and Little Osages, Oklahoma Osage Reservation, the Indians on it are the Great and Little Osages, and some Quapaws. The Osages are generally large and of good form. A large number of men and some of the women, as they grow old, become fleshy, some of them corpulent. As if to back the above statement, We have this remarkable description from George Catlin's letters in the notes of the manners, customs, and conditions of the North American Indians. And among the chiefs of the Osages, are probably next in authority and respect in the tribe, is Tohung Tasabi, or the Black Dog, his pipe in hand, and his tomahawk. There's a picture, his tomahawk in the other, his head shaved and ornamented with a beautiful crest of deer hair, and his body wrapped in a huge Mackinac blanket. This dignitary, who is blind in the left eye, is one of the most conspicuous characters of all his country, rendered so by his huge size, standing in height and in girth above all. His height, I think, is 7 feet, and his limbs full and rather fat, making his bulk formidable, perhaps 300 pounds. This man is chief. This is Catlin, painter, I believe, painting here. That's the picture of Catlin's painting of Tahog's Tasabi. Fascinating. Also, Catlin also remarked that he believed the Osage to be the tallest race of men in North America. Few are less than 6 feet in stature, and many men of them 6.5 and 7 feet. Similarly, the Frenchman Victor Tixier said of Osage in 1840, the men are tall and perfectly proportioned. They have in all the same time all the physical qualities that denote skill and strength combined with graceful movements. It was said of these people that they possessed a comportment that impressed all observers. And Josiah Priest reiterates in his 1834 publication, a person, the Osages are among the largest in person, among the largest and best formed Indians, and are said to possess fine military capacities, but residing as they do in villages and having made considerable advances in agriculture, they seem less addicted to war than their northern neighbors. Within a relatively short space of 100 years or so, it would appear that these people also gradually diminished in height until today they are less known for their ancient bloodline, which produced such elegantly tall people. There is, however, as noted among some, indication that they came originally from the Edina stock, as will be discussed. So, fascinating how these guys grew, where they came from. And the next segment is called the Big Man Systems. Overall, the whole idea of many exceedingly tall, proportionate, and sturdy native people is troubling to traditional evolutionists as well as conventional anthropologists. But with the efforts of some savvy scholars, the taboos withholding entry into Native American intellectual sanctuary are slowly being pulled back. And customary researchers on Palaudinian culture, Richard J. Dent, uses the term big man systems, to denote powerful chieftains in the Chesapeake region, with possible forerunners of such systems stemming back to early woodland times. He does not, however, infer physically large men as heads of their systems, although they have been presented in art. Had there been some field controls put in place even from the colonial period, we might today have a better understanding of the pre-contact world of North America. And Professor of History Alan Gallet offers another scholarly viewpoint in reporting something hardly suggested by any early or middle westland anthropological research, and it scales 700 years of B.C. In the early woodland times of the Great South, chiefs established networks of power, marrying kin into nearby villages from which they received tribute and labor. The grave evidence of the two earlier woodland period segments, as reported by the Old Smithsonian, William Webb, and numerous unofficial sources from the Great Lakes to the Gulf, reports that various mortuary mounds, often enough held, the remains of single individual, a very large size at the base of the structure, and sometimes similar remains at higher levels, denoting, of course, later timelines. Why would there not have been some specialized cronyism in the earlier woodland political systems, with family members being granted chiefdoms in exchange for obedience as a regular price or practice? Moreover, what nurtured the egalitarian politics believed upheld among the early nearly 1,000-year tenure of the Adena people and the earliest woodland settlement? So there was some political form that lasted 1,000 years for those people. Such astute social systems are believed to have flourished over a majority of the Great South's pre-contact region, with any credence given to early Spanish accounts, as noted in the last section. California seems the same, although those accounts are not included in this edition. I got about 3 minutes. I'm just going to read. It says, six reasons of loss. And they're very tall native people. Number one, they're saying why this happened. They say the very tall native people recorded early in American history were said to be of a time-honored tradition of selective mating or marriage, both fragile and in a state of imminent collapse. Like European royalty, there may have been prescribed protocol for marriage among certain families to preserve their genetic lines, sustaining certain physical characteristics, giving rise to a class of nobility over time. And long in political power, family members were given chieftainships and duties affiliated with the seat of influence. The pioneers in their immediate, and number two, the pioneers in immediate generations unearthed so many graves so quickly that the remains of the tall ones rapidly went back to the earth, then contacted with the oxygen of the atmosphere and just destroyed. Number three, we've just got about 2 minutes left. The enduring skeletons of the white man took their disarticled for their skulls, femurs, joints. So in other words, the skeletons were disarticulated. And number four, the federal mandate, Native American Graves Protection and Reparation Act, has given back many bones held in various state institution place of storage, resulting in reburial, and some of the bones of very large individuals, as I have heard through eyewitness. So the Smithsonian gave back some of them, and protecting themselves, the museums that once claimed the larger bones in their itinerary no longer respond to requests for such unusual remains, except in a fashion of denial. And number six, there is also the overlooked issue of the use of heavy equipment destroying artifacts before they are seen, as opposed to the manual mining. That's very true, especially in Iraq and the Middle East right now. I mean, we're building bases and knocking down architectural sites, and the theft, the architectural destruction of the Middle East right now is being devastated. So it's just devastating the entire region, and countless evidence. Evidences of our past and past religions and the center of civilization are being destroyed as we speak. You know, every day. So, as these bombs and heavy equipment and war and guns and just destroy the all remains. But anyway, that's our show tonight. I want to thank everybody for joining. We just lost our stream, but I hope somebody was listening out there. I want to thank, I know there are a lot of people listening to the show. We just reached our 61,000 listener, and this week. And I'm really, really pleased to know that. I want to thank everybody who's been listening to our shows. And if you come to the program, don't think twice. You can just hit the archives, go to our show page, and look at about 500 programs there, going back to November 06. So there's a lot to choose from and a lot of topics to choose from, and we hope you enjoy our many programs for many years to come. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening, and have a great 4th of July. Please join us tomorrow. If you're still listening to this program, please join us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, 8 to 9, and we will be discussing the Giants, the tradition of Giants, with the author Ross Hamlin and our special guest, George Dixon. Good night. That's between 8 and 10.